From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. Ari Berman is a political correspondent for The Nation magazine, a commentator on NPR, and a native of Fairfield, Iowa. In our first half hour, a conversation with Ari Berman about his new book, Herding Donkeys: The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics. He'll tell us why the tremendous grassroots organization the Obama campaign built in 08 didn't translate when it came time to govern. Then, in our second half hour, I'll be joined by Doug Burns from the Daily Times Herald in Carroll, James Lynch from the Gazette in Cedar Rapids, and the Des Moines Register's Jason Clayworth. They'll tell us about some of Iowa's most contentious legislative races. That's all coming up. First, a look at the news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in the second half hour today, we'll talk with reporters covering some of Iowa's most contentious legislative races. It's been an overlooked aspect of this midterm election, the battle for control of the Iowa legislature. But first, my guest today is Ari Berman. He's political correspondent for The Nation, an investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute, and a frequent guest and political commentator on National Public Radio. He's author of the new book, Herding Donkeys: The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics. Ari Berman is also a native of Iowa, of Fairfield. Welcome to our program, Ari.
Thanks a lot. It's nice to be home.
Organizing the Democratic Party has often been described as herding cats. Now, the title of your book is Herding Donkeys: The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics. What is the story that you see that wasn't told about the 2008 election?
Yeah. Well, as we're seeing, herding donkeys may be even more difficult than herding cats, as it turns out. The story that I thought wasn't really being told in as much depth and, I think, perspective after the election as I thought it should be was the whole story of the grassroots political movement that, in my view, really defined Barack Obama's campaign. And what I wanted to do is I wanted to tell that story in two different ways that I thought would be valuable. One was to tell it from the perspective of the organizers and the activists in all these pivotal states that went from red to blue, which I thought was really interesting. And it wasn't quite understood how it happened and how these places changed. And I looked at that as sort of a window into how the country was changing more broadly. And the second thing was to really trace the origins of Barack Obama's political movement and show that really, you know, it started with Howard Dean and with his campaign for the presidency in 2003 and then his chairmanship of the party. And I thought, you know, it seemed to me like Dean was basically being written out of history, that all the accounts of Obama seemed to sort of start with the Obama campaign, whereas, you know, there was this very interesting Democratic uprising that occurred before Obama that in a lot of ways really propelled Obama into the White House. And so I wanted to look at the origins of that and then also its relevance in politics today. And I thought that would differentiate my book from some of the other Obama books that are out there.
So Howard Dean moves into the Democratic National Committee chairmanship. He has a blueprint for a 50-state strategy. How did he implement that?
Well, what he did is he tried to rebuild local Democratic parties in red states and blue states alike and in every state, which was kind of radical in the sense that elections had been won and lost based on a narrow swing state calculation, which is, you know, you put your money in, you know, 18 or 20 states, however many there are, and you focus all your resources on the critical battlegrounds. The problem, as Dean viewed it for the Democrats, is those number of battlegrounds kept shrinking. And so Democrats really didn't have any room to maneuver, and their pathway to 270 electoral votes kept getting slimmer and slimmer. It was all about Florida in 2000. It was all about Ohio in 2004. And Dean wanted to give the Democrats more options. And he really thought that if you didn't rebuild the local Democratic parties, that's where you had to start, because that was going to be the base for all the candidates to be able to run and to win and to really rebrand the Democratic Party in all these places where it wasn't very well liked. And so the way he did that was he gave some money to the state parties, and he gave them money to hire local organizers who would go out and help candidates and also work to reshape the Democratic brand, and also He gave them money to overhaul their technological infrastructure, which is very in the weeds. But, you know, Republicans had really gotten far ahead of Democrats in terms of how to target voters, how to find them, how to collect their data. This was all stuff that the Democrats were really lagging in. And the fact that they started investing in it with Dean was very beneficial in 2008 when, for example, you have all these Hillary Clinton voters after the primary. They all go in to one database so Barack Obama can find them and court them after the primary is over. That sounds like basic politics, but that was some stuff that just wasn't being done. And so Dean thought you could do it everywhere. And I think, you know, it was very controversial. People thought he was just wasting money. But I think, you know, we've seen that Democrats were able to win a lot of races in a lot of states like Idaho, like Mississippi, like Indiana, like Alaska, that nobody
expected. North Carolina, Nevada.
I mean, no one expected it. And some of these guys, unfortunately, are going to lose pretty soon. But the fact of the matter is, Dean showed that it was possible. And then, you know, if the climate gets better for Democrats, it can happen again.
In this story that you're telling of the 2008 election and the origins of this grassroots movement that eventually elected President Obama, who are some of the most pivotal figures? You mentioned Howard Dean, of course, President Obama. Who are some of the figures we may not connect with this movement that were pivotal to its direction and its strategies?
The first half of the book is really about Dean and his activists, and the second part of the book is really about Obama and his activists. And there's some interesting links between those two that I don't think people recognize. I mean, in terms of, for example, the online new media innovation, there's a guy I talk about a lot in the book named Joe Rosebars, who was a young guy, young tech guy, showed up in Burlington to write emails from the Dean campaign, goes and becomes head of new media when Howard Dean becomes head of the DNC, and then now and then became head of new media for the Obama campaign, and essentially, you know, brought in $500 million over the internet and did an incredible amount of work organizing people online. So that was one guy who I didn't think was really part of the conversation, but was an interesting link between those two worlds. Another one who has sort of an opposite background was a guy named Marshall Ganz, who was a lecturer at Harvard and an expert on community organizing. And it just so happened that, you know, Marshall had been doing community organizing for 40 years. And then it just so happened that, you know, he found a candidate at an election in 2008 where community organizing was really front and center. And so both Marshall and Joe worked in the Dean campaign and tried to start fusing essentially online new politics with old school community organizing. And they tried to do it with Dean and they didn't quite get there. But those two worlds really blended very well with Obama.
You argue in your book that the Democratic Party was essentially rebuilt and American politics reshaped in that period, Howard Dean from 2004 to 2008. But when we look at the midterms now, the days from the 2010 midterm election look very much like the politics that we are all very familiar with. So what happened?
Yeah, well, that's the question everyone is asking me right now is what happened. And I think, you know, by and large, the grassroots political movement that defined the Obama campaign did not translate to the Obama White House. And I think it didn't translate, I think, number one, because a lot of the organizers and the activists thought, OK, we elected him. Our job is done. And they sort of sat back. And the other thing is that the Obama people really wasn't a priority for them. I mean, their concern was the inside game of Washington. And they sort of forgot about the outside game outside the Beltway, which was really the perfect mix of the Obama campaign was to try to figure out, you know, how to fuse some of that bottom up energy with a top down structure. And I think in the Obama White House, what happened is it just became a much more conventional, you know, sort of almost 1990s looking White House as opposed to the new politics that Obama wanted to run. And I think, you know, as a result, for whatever reason, a lot of the grassroots and a lot of core Democrats didn't feel like they had a ton of ownership in the White House, whereas at the same time, the Tea Party created a very large backlash against the Obama presidency and then really mobilized their people. And so you have a situation where on the right, there's a lot of energy. And among Democrats, there's a fair amount of confusion because even though Obama has passed a lot of significant stuff. I mean, Democrats not only elected him, but they elected, you know, a huge congressional majority. And they were expecting, I think, two things. One, they were expecting, you know, really far-reaching legislation. And we can argue about whether healthcare and the stimulus and that stuff is that. But I think some of that legislation was less than a lot of rank-and-file Democrats wanted. And then the second thing was that they wanted the legislation passed, I think, in a much smoother way. And all the deals and all the backroom negotiations and the especially healthcare, how long it took, it was an inspiring process to rank and file Democrats. And as a result, they became sort of disillusioned with the presidency as opposed to the energy on the right from the Tea Party.
Okay, so the election in 2008 is done. President Obama comes into office. And I remember in the run-up to his taking the oath of office in January of 2009, that we were to see this new style of campaigning carrying over into governance.
Yeah.
Who dropped the ball?
Yeah. Well, I don't think that the Obama administration ever really made it a priority. I mean, I don't think it was ever particularly tried. I mean, and I think the reason why it wasn't tried, by and large, is because the Obama people really felt like their first priority was to work the legislative process, and they put people in those positions who were inside the Beltway backroom players, chief among them, you know, his departing chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel. And, you know, those guys were old school politicos. They didn't care a whole lot about grassroots mobilization. It wasn't on their radar screen. They didn't think that highly of a lot of these activists and organizers, and they wanted to do things the more traditional Washington way. And I think also Obama was a relatively inexperienced leader. And so he really felt like he needed to lean on a lot of these Capitol Hill people. And he, I think, overlearned the lessons of the Clinton and Carter years, which is that if you bring a bunch of inexperienced people to Washington and alienate Capitol Hill, you won't get things done. So he figured, I'll put all the old legislative hands in my administration, then I won't have that problem. But I think what happened instead is that his unique outsider grassroots reformist brand started getting diluted.
Mm-hmm. Couldn't someone argue that this grassroots type of approach is simply not the way Washington works? It's not the way the sausage gets made.
Yeah. Well, what I always say in response to that is the Obama motto was that grassroots organizing was going to change the Washington sausage making, that you were going to have a mix of the two worlds, that you were always going to make the sausage, but it was going to the organizing and the popular mobilization was going to impact how the sausage was made. And I think the way you could have done that, for example, and I think what they didn't do is, for example, in the healthcare debate, when Max Baucus of Montana was leading the negotiations in the Senate Finance Committee, and these negotiations were going on behind closed doors for a long time with a gang of six senators, you know, Chuck Grassley being one of them. And it didn't really seem like they were making any progress. And at that point in time, a lot of rank and file Democrats really wanted to put pressure on Baucus and other people, and they really wanted him to not only move the bill forward, but move it forward with a public option. And Obama could have turned to his few hundred thousand supporters in Montana, and he said, "You know, hey guys, you know, put some pressure on Max. Let's get this bill moving." But instead, you know, what he did is he said, "You know, listen, I got it. You know, don't worry about it. Let me just deal with this in Capitol Hill." And so, as Marshall Ganz, one of the characters in the book, told me recently, he said, "You know, yes, we can," became "Yes, I can." And I think, you know, that has been problematic because the new model really hasn't been tested.
Would a fence-sitting Democratic senator resent having the president do sort of an end run, get at that senator's grassroots electorate, and put pressure on the senator from below? Would that cause resentment, you think?
It might, but it also might cause results, because I think what the Tea Party has shown is that pressure works. I mean, pressure politics works. I mean, they got involved very much in the weeds of these Republican primaries, and they really pushed the party far to the right. Now, maybe it would be harder to do, and maybe it will be harder for them to do it once these guys are on Capitol Hill. But people respond to their constituents, and during the campaign, a lot of people respected the Obama mobilization because they saw it having an impact. And then when they saw it partially shrivel up after the election, they sort of took it for granted, and they were more worried about the Chamber of Commerce or the Tea Party and all those entrenched forces in Washington who Obama said he was going to fight.
If you just joined us, I'm talking with Ari Berman, the political correspondent for The Nation, and he's the author of the new book, Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics. Let's talk about the Tea Party. That is certainly the story of the 2010 midterm elections. Are you saying that the Tea Party stole a play from the playbook of Obama?
I do, and the Dean playbook. I mean, I think in a few different ways. I mean, I think they saw that in 08 and even before, Democrats were the ones out in the street mobilizing. And they said, this is what we need to do to get people to pay attention to us so they can't just take us for granted. I think they have, in a sense, co-opted his whole message of change, too. Now they're the ones, you know, who are talking about taking the government back, which was actually Take Back America was actually a Dean campaign's slogan, interestingly enough. I also think that in terms of using the internet, mobilizing people online and offline. I mean, there's a lot of innovation going on the Republican side in 2010, and I think that's a direct response to the innovation that was going on the Democratic side in previous elections.
So what happens then to the Tea Party after 2010? How does it morph, move as 2010 becomes 2012?
That's going to be a very interesting question. I mean, the Republican establishment, by and large, except in a few places, has sort of tried to co-opt the Tea Party more recently and work with them. But I think there's a lot of apprehension among Republicans in D.C. about where this goes. For example, after if Republicans take control of the House, for example, how is John Boehner going to deal with all these Tea Party guys? Is he going to let them hold hearings on Obama's birth certificate? I mean, because that really could spark a backlash pretty quickly. Are they going to do something like Newt Gingrich and try to shut down the government, you know, in a fight over spending? I mean, that could also be a backlash. Will they exert a significant influence in the 2012 Republican primary and put someone like Sarah Palin in there instead of Mitt Romney or Tim Pawlenty? I mean, all these are unknown factors. I think they're going to have a very real impact in 2012, and it'll be very real in a place like Iowa, where there already is a lot of conservative and conservative Christian activists.
Conventional wisdom is that President Obama will name a new DNC chair after the midterms to lay the groundwork for the 2012 election. Do you know who's being considered?
Well, they floated Robert Gibbs, the White House press secretary, which I didn't view as a very encouraging sign because Gibbs doesn't have a lot of credibility with rank-and-file Democrats, and that's exactly who the DNC interacts with. He's another hired gun, right? And he's a communications guy. He's
right, and a press spokesman is supposed to be very flat and non-flamboyant and not make a mark.
It was very puzzling. I mean, I sort of tongue-in-cheek suggested they should bring Dean back because which will never happen, of course, but I think someone like that who has credibility among the rank-and-file will be needed in 2012. I think Tim Kaine, is the governor of Virginia, who's the current guy, has done a fairly good job. I mean, you can't really blame him for Obama's political stumbles or the fact that the Democratic base, for whatever reason, is less motivated than they were in 2006 and 2008. I mean, that's really not his fault.
President Obama won some unlikely states in 2008, Indiana, North Carolina, Nevada, and those are not a sure thing for the next presidential election. I wonder what other states are ripe for the type of organizing that could swing into the blue column. Did I read in your book, or was it a typo, you think Texas could one day be blue?
I do. And I think I'm not the only one who believes that. And I didn't say it's going to happen in 2012 or even 2016. But I think if you're looking down the road, 2020 and beyond, I think you're in a situation where the demographic changes are so substantial in Texas. And after the election, one commentator called Obama's coalition the coalition of the ascendant. And I think if you look at that, you know, young people, minorities, particularly Latinos, college-educated voters, that is really growing rapidly in a place like Texas. And I think Democrats, Obama has already sent down 12 Organizing for America staffers down there to start laying the groundwork, which is they realize that if you can cobble together New York, California, and Texas as your big three in a presidential election, I mean, that makes the math very difficult for Republicans.
Are Republicans using these same strategies?
Yes. Republicans have talked pretty openly about using their own 50-state strategy. They're running more candidates for Congress this year than ever before, and they're really trying to make inroads in a lot of blue states. And they seemed poised to do well. Even Tea Party types seem poised to do fairly well in, I think, some moderate to blue states. And it'll be interesting to see, you know, once that happens, whether or not some of the Tea Party types will have to moderate their stances. I mean, because it's such an anti-incumbent election, people aren't paying that much attention to what Republicans are for and their policy positions. But at the same time, I mean, when you do a 50-state strategy, you have to make sure that if you win in some unlikely places, that you're representing the area that you're from. And so just in the same way that the 50-state strategy prompted some discord on the Democratic side, because all of a sudden they had a much bigger, messier tent than they previously had in there, I think they've been struggling with the ramifications of that for a long time. The Republicans could have the same problem if they start winning a lot of seats. It's sort of like a be careful what you wish for situation, and it is a double-edged sword because on the one hand, you do need to elect people in unlikely places to be able to expand your majority or regain the majority. But you also have to have some cohesiveness that ties it all together. So there's not just a lot of disparate elements fighting all the time. And that's one thing I think Democrats have really struggled with their own 50-state strategies. What holds our party together? What's the glue? And they've been looking, I think, for Barack Obama to really be that glue. But I think it's hard to be all things to all people.
Who is the Republicans' Barack Obama potentially for 2012?
Well, they don't have one. I mean, I think the person that's most like Barack Obama is the person down in Florida, Marco Rubio, who is Cuban-American and is very conservative but has crossover potential and a very interesting – in the same way Obama has a very interesting American story, I think Marco Rubio has a very interesting American story. He could very well get elected. He's the front runner now, senator from Florida. I don't think he was going to run in 2012. I mean, even Obama spent 4 years in the Senate. I think Rubio would probably have to spend a little more time. But I think the problem for the Republicans is they have some establishment candidates who, if the economy is bad, could win. I think Mitt Romney and Tim Pawlenty fall into that position. Then they have the sort of more Tea Party types like Sarah Palin, for example, who I don't think would be very well favored or positioned that well in a general election against Obama. Then there's a few wild cards like Mike Huckabee, depending on how they position themselves. But I think the Republicans are going to have very much of an identity crisis in 2012, and they're going to have to sort of balance the activism and the pragmatism in the same way that Democrats have tried and sometimes haven't always succeeded in doing.
Ari, you are a native Iowan. In fact, you're native of Fairfield, Iowa. How did growing up in Iowa influence your views of grassroots organizing?
Yeah, well, I think what it made me interested in was the whole notion that Howard Dean talked about of a 50-state strategy and not just dividing the country into red and blue, because I knew from my own experiences that was a vast oversimplification of the country we're living in. Because as you know, Iowa, some years it's red, some years it's blue, and it has a lot of different pockets within the state. And so I thought this idea, and I had lived in Washington and New York, and I thought this idea that people had on the coasts of sort of red America was a really sort of horrible stereotype. And I thought some of the stereotypes that people in red America had about blue was also kind of a terrible stereotype, you know, and I felt like I had both inside me. Yeah. And so that made me look really closely on, you know, what Dean was trying to do and then what Obama did. And it made it really interesting to me. For example, I was in Indiana before the election. And unlike a lot of reporters, I mean, I felt like I could relate to that a little bit more, that feeling, because I had grown up in the heartland and I knew what it was like. And I knew that it wasn't, you know, just a bunch of country bumpkins out there, that there was real sophisticated voters, you know, in so-called red America. And Barack Obama understood that, too.
Ari Berman, I want to thank you very much for this conversation. Ari Berman, political correspondent for The Nation, author of the new book, Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics. Thanks, Ari, for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
And coming up next, we talk with reporters covering some of the more contentious Iowa legislative races. Ads have been popping up on TV and radio stations around the state in recent weeks. Doug Burns from the Daily Times Herald and Carroll will tell us about the battle over the Iowa House seat once occupied by Republican gubernatorial candidate Rod Roberts. James Lynch from the Gazette in Cedar Rapids will highlight a couple of close state house races in eastern Iowa. And the Des Moines Register's Jason Clayworth weighs in on the races he's watching in the central part of the state. Joining in our conversation, tell us about the state house race in your part of Iowa. Is it nastier than usual in this 2010 midterm election? 1-866-780-9100 is the number to join the conversation. Or you can email us at theexchange@iowapublicradio.org or tweet us at IPR Talk. That's when The Exchange continues from Iowa Public Radio News. It's The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. And finally today, with the election just 4 days away, we want to talk now with political reporters covering some of the more contentious races at a state level in the Iowa legislature. Republicans would need to gain 7 seats in the House, 8 seats in the Senate to regain majorities in those bodies. We have 3 journalists on the line with us, based in 3 parts of the state. We want to pick their brains a little bit, find out what's happening at the state level in the races. We have Doug Burns from the Daily Times Herald in Carroll in western Iowa. Good afternoon to you, Doug.
Good afternoon.
James Lynch is with us in eastern Iowa from the Gazette in Cedar Rapids. James, as always, very nice to have you on the show.
Thanks, Ben.
And Jason Clayworth, right in the middle in the central part of the state, political reporter for the Des Moines Register. Jason.
Hi, Ben.
Hi. Well, I'd like to start out by going around the horn and having each of you share with us a race that you think is interesting in your area, indicative of a trend, contentious or otherwise interesting. And I want to, before I do that, I want to reach out to our listeners to join our conversation. Tell us about a state house race in your part of Iowa, what you think is interesting about it. 1-866-780-9100. Perhaps you've seen an attack ad that you'd like to share. 1-866-780-9100. And our email, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org, on Twitter, @IPRTalk. Can we start with you, Jason Clayworth, in Des Moines? What's a race that you found interesting in during this campaign?
I think that one of the more interesting races is that between Kurt Hansen in Fairfield and Stephen Bergmeier in Lockridge, down in southeastern portion of the state. This is a rematch. There was a special election back in September of 2009 in which Hansen, who is the Democrat, won by 120 votes, a very small margin. And Bergmeier, who is a county supervisor, is now trying to win that seat yet again.
Mm-hmm. And why do you find it interesting?
You know, whenever during the special election, the National Organization for Marriage got involved in this campaign, spent more than $86,000 to advocate for Bergmeier, the Republican. Both candidates said that they would support a vote on a constitutional amendment that on marriage. However, National Organization for Marriage, nonetheless, supported Bergmeier quite aggressively, saying that he was the candidate that would most favor their cause, and it created quite the interesting race. And the rematch within itself has been quite aggressive as well.
Mm-hmm. So this same-sex marriage issue resonating down to the state house level as well. In other races in the House that you've noticed, Jason?
It hasn't come up as much as one might think, and I think that that's partly because we have the statewide Supreme Court retention vote going on. I mean, occasionally we do hear that come up. I just haven't heard it as much as I had expected.
Mm-hmm. Let me turn to Doug Burns in Carroll. There's an interesting race, Doug, in House District 51, a seat now held by State Representative Rod Roberts. He opened the race when he sought the governor's office. He lost a primary to former Governor Terry Branstad, but maintained a campaign pledge not to reenter the race for his House seat. Tell us about the race going on now.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, to Mr. Roberts' credit, he did, although he was encouraged and actually a lot of people really wanted to see him get back into the race, he kept that campaign pledge that he made. And House District 51, which would be all of Carroll County, parts of Crawford, and then up into some reaches of Sac County, has been one of the most reliably Republican seats. I think you saw that evidenced by the fact that Rod received 74% of the vote in Carroll County in his primary bid, and a lot of Democrats crossed over, independents as well, to vote for him, and many of them haven't really crossed back. But we have an interesting race now between a man from rural Auburn, Dan Dirks, who's an extreme social conservative. A lot of the county leadership here has urged him to stick to economic messages, but he just seems congenitally incapable of not bringing up Bible verses and so forth when he's asked about issues. At one forum, he was given a kind of an open field question: what would you do if you could do anything to improve education? And Mr. Dirk said he'd bring back a moment of silence. And then at another forum that was sponsored by the local radio station here, Mr. Dirks was asked a similar question: what would he do to improve education? And he answered that, quote, he would encourage women to stay at home. And then he's running against...
what kind of resonance is that when someone throws out eyebrow-raising comments like those? What kind of feedback does he get?
Well,
any measure of that?
Well, I went out and interviewed a number of particularly working-class women after that, middle-class to working-class women who, you know, may just simply in this economy be in a situation where they might like to work at home, as he's suggesting that they do, stay at home with the kids, and they're just not able to. And it's a tear-jerking, gut-wrenching, soul-ripping decision for a lot of women in that kind of position to decide, do they stay at home or do they work? And for him to insert himself into the debate, it certainly raised eyebrows, and I've even heard from some people who were leaning toward voting for him that they were headed the other direction now. So, in fact,
did I read in your article that he considers himself more of a libertarian and, in fact, says God's a libertarian?
Apparently. I don't know how he's accessing words from above and wisdom from above, but he seems to be a little closer to God than the rest of us, which I think is, you know, some of the residents here find disturbing. You know, our community has had a rich history of cooperation between Catholics and Protestants, and you know, in Rotary settings or in sort of secular governmental settings, if we can, you know, allow our private faith to inspire our public acts, we tend to do better here. And a lot of people, both Republicans and Democrats, are a little bit concerned about what he's about his rhetoric and how that might represent us. When you contrast that with Rod Roberts, who you know, used his very, very strong private faith to inform his public acts.
Who's challenging Dan Dirks? It's
Dan,
an open seat. There's no incumbent here.
A very successful Manila farmer named Dan Muehlbauer, and Mr. Muehlbauer has strong support from the Iowa Democratic Party. I just went through the campaign filing reports last night, and in just 3 weeks alone, from mid-September to early October, the Iowa Democratic Party dropped $35,000 in this House district just on campaign mailers. Some of them have been pretty provocative, and most of them have sought to use Dan Dirks' own words against him.
Doug Burns is with us from Carroll, and he is from the Daily Times Herald in Carroll. Jason Clayworth with us from the Des Moines Register. And we want to turn now to James Lynch in eastern Iowa. James, what race do you want to point out for our listeners?
Well, I think first it's interesting that there are really maybe only one competitive race in the corridor area, Iowa City to Cedar Rapids. There's really only one House seat that looks like it's very competitive. The rest of them, I think incumbents are going to win handily. A race that I'm kind of watching is over in Jones and Dubuque County, Representative Ray Zirkelbach, who served a couple terms, including a term while he was in Iraq with the National Guard, is getting a lot of fire from his Republican challenger, Lee Hine. And I think a lot of people had seen Ray as being fairly safe earlier. I think he's in his 30s. He's works at Anamosa Penitentiary, so had good union support as a National Guard member. I think people looked on him very favorably, but he appears to have a pretty good race on his hands this year. And it's interesting how maybe the you know, the being young and a National Guard veteran, all those things, maybe the bloom is off the rose there. As people are, you know, looking for an alternative.
Any interesting attack ads in this race?
There are some television ads that Republicans are running, talking about Ray Zirkelbach's mixed up priorities and highlighting some things he voted for that benefit Polk County, and said, but wait, isn't Ray supposed to be representing Jones in Dubuque County? And it's a typical attack ad. They've got a picture of Ray that's not real flattering, and goofy music, and, you know, the whole the whole bit that we're used to in these sorts of commercials. It's going to be interesting to see how that plays.
Jason Clayworth of the Des Moines Register. I know the Des Moines Register will be coming out tomorrow with some figures on the money spent on these state races. What can you share with us today?
Yeah, we've been looking at specifically 23 races that we believe are the most competitive. And we came up with those 23 based upon what we're seeing, as well as what House Republicans and Democrats have leaders have both said to us. The fundraising, it's interesting. Republicans from these 23 races have raised roughly $476,000. Democrats in those same races have raised a little over $752,000. So there's a difference there. The amount of cash on hand, which some argue is the most important, however, Republicans are well ahead. They're 332, almost 333,000 versus Democrats at 246,000.
Mm-hmm. Back to James Lynch in Cedar Rapids with the Gazette. Can you describe the political climate in the state when looking at these state races? To what degree they mimic or mirror some of the trends we're seeing on a national basis for the congressional seats?
Well, I think there's some similarity, and I think you have to keep in mind that there are sort of campaigns on two levels when you're talking about legislative races. One is the overarching themes that each party puts forward. For Democrats, it's continuing the progress that they've made in recent years, expanding preschool education, expanding child health care, raising teacher salaries. For Republicans, it's reining in spending, transparency and accountability in government. But then there's also sort of a second level where people look at the candidates as neighbors, as acquaintances, as people they see at the Friday night football game, they see in church on Sunday, they see across the counter, you know, in a business that they have transactions with them. And for many of the people, especially those who aren't hardcore Democrats or Republicans, the swing voters, we might say, or the independent, they maybe look at these people, these candidates, as people first and as party labels second. So you have that dynamic going on where people look at someone and say, well, they were successful in their business. They've done a good job as a city council member. So they'll probably do a good job as a state legislator, and I'll vote for them. So I think that's a dynamic that you don't see so much on a federal level in the congressional races.
Mm-hmm. Any signs of the Tea Party movement in eastern Iowa legislative races? James?
Not overwhelming, although there are sort of pockets within for example, in the 2nd District here, there are some groups that are active, some Tea Party groups that are active and in supporting Marionette Miller Meeks, the Republican challenger to Congressman Dave Lobsack. But it's not really widespread. You run into people who say they're Tea Party members, although membership of the Tea Party is pretty loosely defined, but they're at Republican rallies or they're at a Republican phone bank or something like that. But I'm not seeing widespread or intense Tea Party activity in many of these races.
What about you, Doug Burns, in the western part of the state? Tea Party activity?
I think, we're seeing, I've really only interviewed a couple of people who are specifically members of the Tea Party, but I think you see some Tea Party comments and issues reflected in, for example, the comments below political stories that we have on our website. And certainly all of the attention on the Tea Party nationally, I think, has contributed to a shaping of the agenda locally. Mm-hmm. But in terms of am I seeing, Tea Party activists or people that are out and about in the Carroll area, no.
Mm-hmm. Jason Clayworth of the Des Moines Register, you wrote about in an article, District 8 has a Tea Party darling.
Yeah, that's how he described. He said others have described him. It's Tom Shaw. He is up in Lawrence, and he's the Republican running against a candidate by the name of Susan Banger in Algona. And we have seen some ads there that are very pointed against Bangert. You'll probably have, if you watch TV in the mornings, you'll see some, at least in our area, where Shaw says that her support of Obamacare cost Americans $500 billion, that Iowa has a billion-dollar deficit, and that 21,000 Iowans lost Medicare because of things that she supports. All of those things are what I would call and what others have called gray facts. such as the $1 billion deficit, for example. Iowa does not have a deficit. That $1 billion that they're referring to is often referred to as a projected gap for upcoming years. It's something that lawmakers work on every single year. It's common to have hundreds of millions of dollars in such gaps. So we see things like that. We see that the Republican Party in general is trying to nationalize these local races and bring these national issues into these local races, as we see in the Banger ad.
Jason Clayworth of the Des Moines Register, also with us, James Lynch of the Gazette in Cedar Rapids, Doug Burns of the Daily Times Herald in Carroll. Just a few minutes left, gentlemen. I wanted to see just sort of throw this out. If anyone had a favorite political anecdote from covering this year's midterm elections to share with us, pipe up if you do.
Well, I would.
Okay. Go ahead. Was that Jason or who was that?
It was Doug and Jason. Jason, go ahead.
Okay.
Oh no, James, go ahead.
James, go ahead.
Okay, I'll go ahead. I just had a cute little incident yesterday. I was at the Branstad rally in Coralville, and there was a guy there who was on leaving the rally to go get his marriage license. He had a woman who he had previously known. He really got to know her during the campaign. He said they spent a lot of nights putting up campaign signs, and he proposed to her the day of the Republican convention. After the convention, they went to a jewelry store, and he bought her an engagement ring. So he's saying that he's going to be a double winner when Branstad wins on Tuesday.
Okay. Who had the other anecdote out there?
Ben?
Yes.
Yeah, Doug and Carol.
Hey, Doug, yeah.
I'd say right after Kim Reynolds was named as Branstad's running mate, she came here and campaigned at a pizza ranch in Carroll. And, of course, she was sent out on that sort of first campaign swing to try to appeal to Western Iowa conservatives, people who may have supported Mr. Vanderplaats or Mr. Roberts. And we interviewed her at the pizza ranch and asked her some basic foundational questions that of the conservative movement. Whether people are born gay or can change, questions about, what should the penalty be for a woman who has an abortion or a doctor who performs one if her view prevails and abortion is made illegal. Just, these basic philosophical questions that most conservatives, intellectual conservatives that I've interviewed over 20 years would relish answering and would embrace the questions. And it was just clear that she'd never even consider these. I looked at her. And we have the interview on video, and it was really striking to me that she had simply not rolled over in her mind or put together any kind of a world view on this, and it was quite stunning to me.
Interesting, Doug. I want to end up here by getting your words on predictions. If my numbers are correct, Republicans need to gain 7 seats in the House, 8 seats in the Senate to regain a majority. What are we looking at, possibly, Jason Clayworth, when you run the numbers?
I think that it's absolutely impossible to predict because these are very localized races. We see it time and time again. We see that a lot of times whenever the national races sway towards one way, Iowa's local races do not. So I think it's very difficult. Of course, Republicans seem to have the momentum. We cannot deny that. But at the same time, Democrats have for years been very aggressive in how they pinpoint their various elections. They recruit candidates that represent their district quite well. We have a number of conservative Democrats. So I think that it's really a toss-up. It's hard for me, at least, to predict accurately what might happen.
In the remaining minute or so, I want to you're all political reporters here, heavy into politics. Obviously, you love it. We have a short breather after this election coming up next week, and then not too long, we get a breath and then dive right into the caucus campaign season. James Lynch, do you see anything there that you can tell us about how that season will start off here in Iowa?
Well, I think a lot of people would say, Ben, that it's already started. We saw a lot of possible 2012ers traveling with Governor Branstad. Ron Paul is in the state. So I think the caucus campaign has started. One of the things that I think will be interesting is to see whether Tea Party activists who have engaged with the Republican Party will stay engaged through the caucus and what impact that will have on the party and how candidates are received in Iowa. Certainly, you would suspect that more conservative presidential hopefuls would get a better reception from those folks.
Okay, Dan, Doug Burns, a final word from you. We have a few seconds left.
Well, I think you are right. When 2012 is really just right around the corner, and I went to the Sarah Palin event in Des Moines. She certainly has people energized, but I would say, you know, Governor Branstad has spoken a lot about Mitch Daniels, the governor of Indiana. He's somebody I would watch, and, of course, Chris Christie in New Jersey seems like the kind of man that Iowa conservatives could warm to.
Okay.
But it'd be interesting to see if Branstad, if he is elected, as in, you know, on Tuesday, if that gives any kind of a boost to the fortunes of Mitch Daniels here.
Anything to add that in a few seconds, Jason Clayworth of the Des Moines Register?
We will see Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty here Sunday. I think that he's another one to keep our eye on.
Okay. Jason Clayworth, James Lynch, Doug Burns, thank you for popping in on our radio waves to tell us a little bit about the state legislative races, how they tie into other races, and the coming 2012 race. Thank you, gentlemen.
You're welcome.
The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Production assistance today from Lindsay Moon. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. And we always welcome your comments and questions about this program, The Exchange, at iowapublicradio.org. Monday on Talk of Iowa at 10 o'clock with my colleague Charity Nebbe. It'll be about reclaiming your holidays, practical ways we can create meaning while reducing stress and waste. Coming up at 10 o'clock on Monday, The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend, great Halloween. Thanks for joining us.